We just hope that it's the beginning of better decision making and more close listening to Alaskans for the short and long term.
An extension for comments on the F-16 move from Fairbanks to Anchorage. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, June 10th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, scientists and logging interests face off on greater protections for Tongass salmon streams.
Salmon populations have more than doubled since we started logging here 50, 60 years ago, so it's totally unnecessary.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Children need at least 60 minutes of physical activity each day for good health. So to help your children hit that mark, find fun ways to add more activity to their day. Go for a walk together. Sign up for events in your community. Make time to be physically active as a family. Get out and play with your kids every day. For activity ideas and tips on raising healthy kids in Alaska, visit playeveryday.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
The Air Force will give Alaska's leaders and the public an extra month to compile their comments on a draft environmental impact statement released last month. The EIS evaluates the effects of the Air Force's proposal to relocate a squadron of F-16s from Eielson Air Force Base to Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson. As KUAC's Emily Schwing reports, the extension comes after pushback from the state's congressional delegation, who argued the military hadn't provided the public with enough time to evaluate the document.
Originally, the Air Force granted the public only 10 working days to compile their comments. But after arguments from the congressional delegation and others, Pentagon officials have agreed to delay hearings for a month. Matthew Felling is the communications director for Senator Lisa Murkowski. He says he hopes this is a sign the Air Force plans to work more closely with Alaskans at all levels.
We just hope that it's the beginning of better decision-making and more close listening to Alaskans for the short and long term. Because this, at the end of the day, is just pushing pause for a month. And that in and of itself doesn't indicate or doesn't change a whole lot. But if it is the beginning of a larger trend, then that could have some seriously positive effects in terms of what this won't do to Alaska.
Felling says constituents are weighing in from across the state on the Air Force's proposal to relocate the F-16s.
There is a large contingent of people not only who have begun seeing the reasons to explain why this is bad, but they also see that the Air Force unfortunately seems determined to run through all these stop signs.
Local officials in Fairbanks are also pleased with the extension. Fairbanks North Star Borough Mayor Luke Hawkins said via text message, the achieved pushback from officials gives Alaskans footing to, quote, now tell our story to the Air Force and explain why the draft EIS has holes in it, unquote. Public hearings were originally scheduled to begin in Palmer on June 17th, with three others scheduled in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and North Pole. The hearings have been rescheduled for July 15th through the 18th. Locations and times have not yet been finalized. In Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
A group of scientists is calling on Congress to provide greater protection from development for scores of streams on Southeast Alaska's Tongass National Forest. The effort is called the Tongass 77 and asks Congress to apply a more restrictive land use designation, the equivalent of a zoning classification, for nearly 2 million acres around 77 Tongass fish streams. John Shane, science advisor emeritus with Audubon Alaska, explained during a teleconference today.
Our interest in the Land Use Designation 2, which was established in 1990 under the Tongass Timber Reform Act, is to allow a variety of uses, but particularly to protect these very important salmon-producing watersheds from roads and clear-cut logging that have potentially very long-term impacts on salmon. So we envision this protection, not as a very strict wilderness designation, but a broader designation that really focuses on the conservation of fish and wildlife.
Audubon Alaska, Trout Unlimited, and 230 scientists sent a letter to Congress seeking the change in land use. Jack Williams, senior scientist with Trout Unlimited, said the streams needed more than the 100-foot buffer strips enforced on Tongass streams.
With the existing rainfall, steep slopes, that a lot of these drainages have and experience, the 100 feet just isn't adequate to really protect these streams, especially if we have timber harvest, road building, those kinds of things. So it's really this watershed scale approach that to protect these best remaining areas, it really does make the most sense.
The coalition of scientists identified the 77 streams as the highest value unprotected watersheds on the forest and argue that salmon should be the top priority for managing Tongass lands. The group said the watersheds face threats from logging, road building, hydroelectric development, and proposed land exchanges, and they hope the proposal will be picked up and supported by members of Congress. Wayne Owen, the U.S. Forest Service Alaska Region Director of Wildlife, Fisheries, and Watersheds, said the Tongass National Forest is currently reviewing its land management plan, welcomes the interests, and will take the Tongass 77 proposal into consideration. Loss of timber management areas is not a popular idea with the timber industry. Owen Graham, executive director of the Alaska Forest Association, calls the proposal unnecessary and says many of the watersheds listed have no development planned.
The buffer strips required on all streams, and the Forest Service manages even larger buffer strips than the law requires on many of the streams. Salmon populations have more than doubled since we started logging here 50, 60 years ago, so it's totally unnecessary, and what we really need to focus on is restoring a timber supply and timber jobs.
One member of Alaska's congressional delegation has little interest in the Tongass 77 proposal. Congressman Don Young called it a fundraising tool and said it won't see the light of day while he is in Congress. Meanwhile, Alaska Senator Mark Begich says he's looking at the proposal and how it fits with another bill to convey some Tongass lands to the Sea Alaska Regional Native Corporation.
Now, this one, their point is a good point, as you want to preserve some of these areas, these watersheds, for long-term benefit to our fisheries and to the habitat that's in that region. And so we're looking at it. We haven't made any decision on it, but we're now looking at it, as we know now, Sea Alaska's moving forward. So they've done a lot of work, and we're talking to them about, you know, is it 77? Is it 25? Is it 92? You know, I don't know exactly how they got to that number, but I know that's the watersheds they thought were the most at risk and should be protected. So we're now talking about how does this fit in with the Sea Alaska and what does that do to your numbers?
The 77 watersheds are scattered throughout southeast from Yakutat to the southern end of Prince of Wales Island. The Sea Alaska Land Bill is scheduled for markup during a congressional hearing this week. Representative Don Young's main legislation would convey about 70,000 acres of Tongass National Forest timberlands to Sea Alaska. The Sea Alaska measure is one of 14 land bills before the House Committee of Natural Resources, which meets Wednesday. The Senate is also expected to mark up its version of the Sea Alaska lands legislation soon. Robert Dillon, spokesman for sponsor Lisa Murkowski, says it's tentatively scheduled for June 18th before the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the loss of a prominent elder on St. Paul Island.
She helped bring things back. She helped keep things going so that it would outlive all the elders and be passed down to the other generations.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. Complete a bachelor program without leaving home. Whether a first time or a transfer student, the University of Alaska Southeast has the degree for you. Visit ketch.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast.
The Federal Emergency Management Agency toured Galena over the weekend to estimate how much monetary damage was done by this year's flood. State of Alaska Emergency Management Specialist George Coyle says if FEMA determines damage is significant enough to declare Galena a federal disaster area and President Obama approves, the federal government would pay 75% of the total estimated damage cost, while the state of Alaska would foot the other 25%.
It's a savings to the state of Alaska on, you know, recovery costs and stuff. Alaska is one of the few states that does the 25%. if not the only one that matches that 25%. So other states might match 10% or something, and then the other 15 is borne by the communities and the entities, depending on what their damages are.
FEMA will likely make its ruling within the next 7 to 10 days. The state is reporting progress in Galena as the community cleans up from major flooding. The ice jam flood earlier this month damaged and destroyed many homes and other buildings, forcing the evacuation of most of the village's 400 residents. The State Division of Emergency Management says power has been restored to most areas of Galena, fuel service has resumed, and the local public radio station is back on the air. The road to the Galena landfill remains impassable, and a hazardous materials team is working on containment, assessment, and cleanup. Most evacuated Galena residents remain in Fairbanks, Anchorage, or other communities. Galena's boarding school, a former Air Force facility inside a diked area protected from the flood, is serving as a shelter for residents who did not evacuate, as well as housing emergency responders. State Response Manager Claude Denver says the school facility, which includes rooms and a dining hall, is ideal.
Not many communities have a unused little city that could be turned on. So we're like, okay, so we considered ourselves fortunate.
Galena school employee Ben Velasco says operation of the dorms, normally closed for maintenance in the summer, has been ramped up.
Turned our student dormitory into our place where people stay while they're here in Galena, kind of a hotel, if you will, for evacuees and our refugees, and also for the workers that come in and the Red Cross folks and all those people.
Velasco says the dorms, which also have laundry facilities, are providing the basic necessities.
Housing, hot showers and clean towels and bedding, and then we also provide shower facilities for, there's some folks who are staying in their homes still, some homes that can get too damaged and livable still.
Velasco says the dorms can handle more than 300 people, depending on the number staying in each room. Officials are stocking the school with sufficient supplies to support the return of flood evacuees. City and tribal leaders plan to implement a return plan this week when local conditions are deemed safe. An Interior Alaska militia group gathered over the weekend near Delta Junction. The Central Alaska Militia's leader says the group is not associated with the defunct Fairbanks-based Alaska Peacemakers Militia. That group's leader, Schaefer Cox, was sentenced to 26 years in prison earlier this year for plotting to kill government officials. KUAC's Tim Ellis visited the weekend militia gathering at a remote site off the Alaska Highway.
The encampment resembled a hunting camp, except for the several flags that were flapping in a Saturday afternoon breeze, including a yellow flag with a coiled snake and the words, "Don't tread on me." About 20 people dressed in camouflage were seated in a circle listening to a briefing by a camo-clad man wielding a rifle as an instructional aid. David Luntz, the interim commander of the Central Alaska Militia, came out to greet a visitor and agreed to an interview. And although he clearly was a bit uncomfortable and chose his words carefully, he really wanted to get the word out that his group is not affiliated with Schaefer Cox's Fairbanks-based militia.
What happened in Fairbanks really soured public opinion of militias.
Luntz says members of his group do not share Cox's apocalyptic vision of extremist militiamen waging war against a tyrannical federal government bent on enslaving Americans.
What we do is a little bit different. You know, we're a citizens' militia based off our constitutional and natural rights.
One might hear, during a conversation with Luntz, some of the sort of language that Cox and like-minded militia types use, and some may be disturbed by some of the content on the Central Alaska Militia's website online forum or the site's Acts of War page that lists provocations such as the elimination of gold, cash, or barter. But Luntz says there are many differences between his organization and extreme militias. He cites his group's support for state sovereignty instead of sovereign citizens, who believe they do not have to follow any law but their own conception of natural or divine-inspired law. And, unlike Cox's group, Luntz says members of the Central Alaska Militia get along well with state law enforcement officers.
We communicate with the troopers, And I know I have some friends that are troopers. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not worried about them. We're not doing anything that we need to worry about.
Luntz is a retired soldier who works as an Army civilian on Fort Greely. He says most of the militia's members are veterans, and he says all like to hunt, shoot, and spend time in the wilderness. This weekend's training sessions included learning the basics of putting together patrols and responding to ambushes. Luntz says the Central Alaska Militia is trying to model itself on the first American militias, which were dedicated to serving their communities. He says, among other things, his organization will be helping out local food banks and supporting search and rescue efforts.
We've got some folks that have been trained as state EMTs, and we're working on getting other people trained, and then we're going to work on forming up a search and rescue team to help in the local area.
Alaskan militiamen possess a wide variety of skills, says Mikel Insalako, the founder of the Anchorage Municipality Defense Force, who was among several militia members from South Central and the Kenai who showed up for last weekend's get-together.
In addition to having officers over engineering, so construction, rebuilding, things like that, we have a medical services officer, and the way that we're building our group is the way that we want to be able to protect and provide as an asset for our community.
Insalako says the Anchorage Militia, along with others, is trying to develop leaders who could help their communities in times of natural or man-made crisis. In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
A visitor shot a moose in the entrance area of Denali National Park. The animal was wounded and put down by park rangers. KUAC's Dan Bross has more on the unusual incident.
The June 6th moose shooting is the first by a visitor to Denali National Park. Park spokeswoman Chris Pfister says the incident happened on a trail near the Denali Visitor Center.
When we got there, the moose wasn't dead, and so we destroyed it. And the reporting party said that they had been hiking with a family, and the moose had come around a corner in the trail, and the moose charged them, and they tried to hide behind a tree, but the moose still kept coming toward them, and fearing for their safety, that was why the moose was shot.
Federal law changed in 2010 to allow members of the public to carry guns within national parks, including the core area of Denali, where they were previously banned from doing so. Pfister says it remains illegal to fire a gun in the park unless it's in self-defense. That was the case when a grizzly bear was shot and killed by a hiker in the Igloo Creek area of Denali in May 2010. Pfister says the circumstances of last week's moose shooting are being investigated. The moose was a cow that was lactating, but Pfister says rangers did not see any calves.
If we do confirm that there were orphan calves, I mean, we are looking into what our options are. It's not a situation we've been faced with before, and so we just have to sort of see, you know, if we do have any other options other than potentially destroying them.
Pfister did not know whether that includes capturing calves and taking them to a wildlife park. Meat from the dispatched moose was salvaged. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, publishing statewide news on Alaska's business sector, government, and industry since 1985. Information and subscriptions online at akbizmag.com. Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
The Pribilof Island of St. Paul lost an important elder this month. Mary Nikolai Bordakovsky passed away at age 90. As KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal reports, Bordakovsky was devoted to preserving Unungan culture and history.
Bordakovsky was born January 9, 1923, to Nikolai and Olga Kozlov on St. Paul Island. She was a fixture in many regional Native organizations throughout her life and even traveled to the Smithsonian Institution to consult on the museum's Alaska Native collections. But her close family friend, Sharon Svarney Livingston, says some parts of Unungan history were hard for Bordakovsky to share.
And one of the things that she was always really adamant about remembering, even though she didn't like to talk about it very much, was the internment during World War II.
Bordakovsky was pregnant and already had two small children when St. Paul was evacuated in 1942. She and other Pripilof Island residents were taken to Funter Bay in southeast Alaska. The conditions at the camp there were horrendous. Even though it was painful to discuss, Bordakovsky didn't want it to be forgotten, so she allowed herself to be interviewed for Aleut's Story, a 2005 documentary about the Aleut internment. As Bordakovsky describes in this clip from Aleut's Story, she and other Unangan women in the camp decided to lobby the government for better treatment.
So we all got together and had a meeting, and then we wrote this letter. I'll read it. We, the people of this place, wants a better place than this to live. This place is no place for a living creature. We drink in pure water and then get sick. The children get skin disease. Why they not take us to a better place to live and work for ourselves? Do we have to see our children suffer? We all have rights to speak for ourselves.
After the war, Bordakovsky returned to St. Paul to raise her family. She had seven children of her own, but she taught dozens more at Unangan culture and science camps throughout the state. Her friend Svarni Livingston taught with her at Unalaska's Camp Kanayu. Svarni Livingston says Bordakovsky's skills seem to go on forever.
Basketry, dance, song, language. I mean, she knew everything. You could ask her to teach something and she would know how to teach it.
Bordakovsky was a patient and engaging instructor, and she returned to many camps year after year to teach. But she had a special link to the children of St. Paul, her home village. She taught at a marine stewardship camp there a few years back. Before Bordakovsky left, her young students gave her a nickname.
And they called her Stuparach Anava, which means mending mother. And it was probably given to her by them because of all the crafts she taught them with the sewing and, you know, with the seal gut and the fur seals. But I think it came to mean to everybody else that she kind of was the mending mother of the culture. She helped bring things back. She helped keep things going so that it would outlive all the elders and be passed down to the other generations.
Bordakovsky was laid to rest in St. Paul on Saturday. She's survived by four sons and her sister, Justina Gilmore. In on Alaska, I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
Recently, a group of more than 70 elders took a bus about an hour southeast of Anchorage as part of the South Central Foundation's Elders Program. They were gathering and learning about the healing properties of plants. Jacqueline Estes has the latest story in our ongoing series looking at culture in Alaska.
Kim Asplund is a health educator at the South Central Foundation Health and Wellness Center.
Yarrow, if you put it in your mouth and chewed it up a little bit and put it on something that was bleeding, it's good to stop the bleeding right away.
She's talking with some of the elders on an outing, first to Whittier, then to the Moose Flats picnic area in Portage Valley. They're harvesting plants Alaska natives have used as food or medicine for thousands of years.
As it blossoms, it has little white flowers on the end.
What's that
now?
Yarrow.
Yarrow.
Asplund leads harvesting trips in the spring and fall. This is the first time Caroline Dementev has come along. She's originally from Holy Cross, a Yukon River village in western interior Alaska.
So it's a world of education, health education, and just promises you well-being. So I know that I'm learning a whole bunch of stuff, but I did know stuff about the dandelion. The whole thing is good for you. And then the root, if you dry it and grind it up, it's good for coffee substitute, see?
The group slowly scatters across the picnic area in pursuit of plants such as dandelion and fiddlehead fern. Sharon Dye is originally from Sand Point in the Aleutians.
What do you have here?
I have cottonwood buds. I've learned this in the elders program about making a... It's kind of like for pain relief. You put these in olive oil and leave it there for like 2.5 weeks or so. I think in the sun, so that the sun, it infuses the, and then you strain it and you can rub it on your arthritis or whatever and it takes the pain away.
Have you actually tried it?
Yes, I have. It does work.
Everyone moves to a campfire to toast marshmallows and hear from Marianne Lila. director of the Plants for Human Health Institute at the State University of North Carolina. The day before, she helped teach a two-day class for students, elders, and scientists on how to test the chemical makeup of plants to measure their healing properties. She's been coming to Alaska for several years now and is particularly interested in berries.
I'm such a berry advocate because blueberries in particular have such a wealth of efficacies for human health, everything from diabetes to cardiovascular disease to obesity and metabolic syndrome to cancer.
Lila says plants develop chemical defenses against the environment. Those defenses include antioxidant, antibiotic, and other healing properties. And because many Alaskan plants live on the margins of survival, their defenses make stronger medicine than plants in other climates.
The thing that makes plants so wonderful is they have a whole cornucopia of phytochemicals that interact together and attack human disease conditions from many different angles at once. So if one thing isn't working so well, another thing will. And that's what gives them such broad spectrum protection.
So you peel off this bark. You peel off the thorns, you know.
Wearing gloves and using a pocket knife, Kim Asplund is peeling a dry stalk of last year's Devil's Club. She says over the years, she's learned more from elders than she's taught them.
My husband is familiar with this stuff.
He
makes tea out of that.
She says part of the healing for these elders is just getting outside, getting a taste of home.
Oh, this tip right here is delicious. Do you want to taste a little bit of it?
Yeah, I do.
The fresh new Devil's Club tip tastes like a spruce tree smells, kind of like spring. I'm Jacqueline Estes.
Yes, peel back the bark. And this bark right here.
I like the smell.
Oh, I love the smell.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Emily Schwing and Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Joe Vicknicki in Petersburg, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Jeremy Scott in Galena, Tim Ellis in Delta, Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska, and Jacqueline Estes in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years.
And by
Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oilfield services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
The Alaska Nanook Commission reminds you that harassing polar bears or taking polar bears with cubs is not only illegal, but it is not part of native traditions. Together with their management partners at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Alaska Nanook Commission has been working on developing a long-term polar bear deterrence plan to protect Alaska's villages from dangerous polar bear encounters. More at the AlaskaNanookCommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission, Alaska's people managing Alaska's resources. Share your culture and create lifelong connections by welcoming an AFS International exchange student into your home for a year, semester, or 6 to 12 weeks. Information at 1-800-AFS-INFO. This message sponsored by AFS USA.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.